stay tuned for Professor Rick Wolf. But first, we are going to WPFW. We have an impeachment update. This is WBAI New York.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad, and this is an impeachment update. The Senate has voted to acquit President Trump on two articles of impeachment. With 67 votes needed to convict him, only the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. The final vote on the first article, abuse of power, was 48-52. The second article, obstruction of Congress, was also defeated along straight party lines, 47-53.
The presiding officer directs judgment to be entered in accordance with the judgment of the Senate as follows. The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, President of the United States, upon two articles of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present not having found him guilty of the charges contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charges in said articles.
10 women who broke off from a U.S. Capitol tour were arrested today while sitting in the rotunda and demanding that senators vote to remove Trump. The group members left the tour in the afternoon as the Senate prepared to vote on whether to convict or acquit the president following his House impeachment trial. The women who came to the district from all around the country sat in the middle of the rotunda chanting, "Trump is guilty. Acquittal is a cover-up, and honor your oaths." Moderate Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska called Trump's push for Ukraine to investigate Democrats inappropriate, but both voted against removing him from office. Vulnerable Democrat Doug Jones of Alabama, however, said he did, and he did vote to convict, as did Republican Mitt Romney of Utah.
The allegations made in the articles of impeachment are very serious. As a senator juror, I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. I am profoundly religious. My faith is at the heart of who I am. I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong. The House managers presented evidence supporting their case, and the White House counsel disputed that case. In addition, the president's team presented three defenses. First, that there could be no impeachment without a statutory crime. Second, that the Biden's conduct justified the president's actions. And third, that the judgment of the president's actions should be left to the voters. Let me first address those three defenses. The historic meaning of the words high crimes and misdemeanors, the writings of the founders, and my own reasoned judgment convinced me that a president can indeed commit acts against the public trust that are so egregious that while they are not statutory crimes, they would demand removal from office. To maintain that the lack of a codified and comprehensive list of all the outrageous acts that a president might conceivably commit renders Congress powerless to remove such a president defies reason. The president's insistence that they be investigated by the Ukrainians is hard to explain other than as a political pursuit. There's no question in my mind that were their names not Biden, the president would never have done what he did. The defense argues that the Senate should leave the impeachment decision to the voters. While that logic is appealing to our democratic instincts, it is inconsistent with the Constitution's requirement that the Senate, not the voters, try the president. Hamilton explained that the founders' decision to invest senators with this obligation rather than leave it to the voters was intended to minimize, to the extent possible, the partisan sentiments of the public at large. So the verdict is ours to render under our Constitution. The people will judge us for how well and faithfully we fulfill our duty. The grave question the Constitution tasks senators to answer is whether the president committed an act so extreme and egregious that it rises to the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Yes, he did. The president asked a foreign government to investigate his political rival. The president withheld vital military funds from that government to press it to do so. The president delayed funds for an American ally at war with Russian invaders. The president's purpose was personal and political. Accordingly, the president is guilty of an appalling abuse of public trust.
Utah Republican Mitt Romney. Meanwhile, Trump gave the annual State of the Union address last night. During his 78-minute speech, he made his case for re-election while touting the economy, trying to stoke fear and xenophobia about criminal aliens, and calling public schools government schools. A number of Democratic lawmakers protested his address. Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, Tim Ryan of Ohio, New Jersey's Bill Pascrell, and Seth Moulton of Massachusetts all walked out of Trump's speech. Others didn't attend at all, including New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, Al Green of Texas, Georgia's Hank Johnson, Tennessee's Steve Cohen, Oregon's Earl Blumenauer, Florida's Frederica Wilson, Mississippi's Benny Thompson, Bobby Rush of Illinois, and California's Maxine Waters. Democratic Congress members who did attend the speech also broke into chants of H.R. 3 when Trump spoke about lowering drug prescription prices. H.R. 3 is a House-passed bill that would require Medicare to negotiate for lower prices on insulin and other life-saving medications. Trump refused to shake House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's hand. She later ripped up a copy of his speech after he finished speaking, saying, quote, "It was a manifesto of mistruths." For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, this has been an impeachment update. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Richard Wolff from the program Economic Update that I hope many of you are familiar with. We try to produce on a regular weekly basis a way to look at the economic phenomena of our lives, what's happening to our wages, our debts, our income, our prospects for ourselves, for our kids. And to do it in a way that deals with the realities, not what's in the newspaper and not what's in the mouths of the political leadership that we have to support. It's a pleasure for me to do this. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, as those of you who followed my work know. But now I have an opportunity, thanks to WBAI, which, by the way, was the first station that offered me an opportunity to go beyond teaching in a classroom and begin to present all that I've learned, hopefully in understandable ways, to a much larger audience. We've grown a lot since BAI first offered me the opportunity, which was back in March of 2011, quite a while ago. The program is now carried simultaneously on just under 100 stations across the United States, and we produce a television version at the same time that goes into roughly 55 million homes in the United States. Quite an achievement, and the testimony that it represents is not testimony about the program. I hope it's a good program, but that's not what makes it successful. What makes it successful is the audience. It's people like you. And you made it successful in two ways. One, by being interested, by sending in questions, by communicating what you thought and hopefully liked about the program. But the second way you've made all this possible is part of why we're here tonight. It's making available whatever dollars you can spare. I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't have the audience I now have or the reputation I have built up if it weren't for the courage of WBAI, for being here in the first place, for having an audience, for seeing that that audience might find it interesting to have a program like Economic Update. And so I'm, in a way, a personal testimony, which I am happy to deliver, about the importance of having an alternative news source, an alternative source of information, but not just information, also an alternative way to make sense of what's going on every day. We need that. We need that to keep our sanity in a society that is in very deep trouble. Many of you may have listened to the president's speech, State of the Union. And I remember that I've had the same feeling on occasion with other presidents, so I don't mean to single him out. But my first reaction was listening was to wonder how it came to be that we, that is he and I, live on such different planets, see the world in such different ways, make sense of it in such different ways. Now, of course, I'm not having to run for re-election the way he is, so I don't quite have to make things up on the scale that he does. But I see the world in a radically different way. Let me give you an example, and in the hopes that maybe it stimulates some of you to call in. We have telephones available. We have a live show tonight. I'm sitting here in the WBAI studio, so you can talk to me and I can talk to you, which is a wonder of modern technology. But let me give you an example of the speech last night. Mr. Trump refers to the economy as great. I know that if he were talking like that in a classroom of a professor of economics like myself, whether he was right wing, left wing, really wouldn't matter. The arguments he gave would embarrass a mediocre freshman in a class. The idea that you can refer to the economy as great when the following statistics are correct, and his advisors, some of whom I know personally, have told him this. Here we go. Just a laundry list, quickly. We have the greatest level of inequality in the United States in a century, and it has gotten worse under each of the 3 years of Mr. Trump's presidency. It wasn't good to begin with, but he made it worse. The tax cut in December 2017 was a gift to the richest people in America at the end of a 20-year period when they needed it less than anybody else. It was outrageous. And the health of an economy is measured, among other ways, by how unequal it is. Let me give you another example. The level of debt now carried in the United States by the government, by corporations, by students to get through school, and by families in terms of their credit card and so on, is at record levels, and the debt story has gotten worse, significantly worse, under the last 3 years of Mr. Trump. Let me continue. We are being dealt with around the world as a pariah country. You can't risk doing business with the United States. Every other country is learning. And by every other country, let me be clear with you. Mexico, Canada, China, India, Europe. Every one of them has been attacked by Mr. Trump's government. Tariffs have been slapped on them, which is a tax that hurts. Trade wars have been launched against them. And in reaction, they're doing what any business anywhere would do. If you can't rely on the United States to play the game the way it's been played for decades, you're going to take your business someplace else. Trade between Russia and China, 50% higher than when Mr. Trump became president. Trade between every part of the world with one another is zooming. They're not going to do business with the United States. It's too dangerous. Some local politician, like Trump, will take extraordinary steps that hurt them, and they're not going to remain vulnerable to all of that. I could go on, but any honest assessment of the American economy would look at the facts I've just mentioned, and dozens more. Here's a record for you to think about. 1.5 million school children were homeless during the last year. They were homeless, which sets them back further than they already were. Can't do your schoolwork if you're running around from one shelter to another. What kind of a country does that? What kind of a country pretends that's not going on? What kind of a president pretends that the economy is great when I just gave you a statistic that he knows just as well as I do? We have a booming economy only in the sense that the number of people listed as unemployed is lower than it's been in the past. Now, while that's very nice news, by itself, it doesn't tell you anything. Suppose I were to tell you that, yes, fewer people are unemployed, but the wages of the people who have those jobs are worse than they've ever been. That the benefits that go along with that job are fewer than they've ever been, and that the security of that job is less than jobs used to carry. That would put a different picture, wouldn't it, on these numbers? Maybe what the low unemployment numbers are about is the following, and this would be my analysis. The great crash of capitalism in 2008 and 2009 threw millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people out of work around the world. Those people suffered. First thing they did was use up whatever little savings they had left. Second thing they did is they relied on family and friends to help them through these hard times. Here in the United States, somewhat over between 4 and 5 million people lost their homes because they couldn't make the mortgage payments. After 4 or 5 years of using up your savings and scrimping by and getting help from your relatives and friends, you've run out. And now you're desperate. You don't have any more unemployment compensation you can draw on. Friends and family and savings are not available anymore. And guess what? You might not have been willing to take a job as a Walmart greeter who gets paid $9 an hour or in that neighborhood before, but you'll take it now. So, yeah, you have a job, but your life is completely different from what it was before. You would not describe your situation as great, because it isn't. And the president who tells you it is trying to get your vote by literally babbling an alternative to a reality he can't face. Looking at the number of unemployed, which is all Mr. Trump ever does, would be the equivalent of going to a doctor, telling him about the enormous pains you have, having him stick a thermometer in your mouth. It comes out 98.6. Oh, you're fine. Go home. You're smart enough. You would never go to that doctor again because you know to test your health, lots of statistics have to be looked at. That's why they have blood tests and x-rays and all the rest of the equipment. We have that in economics, too. Mr. Trump doesn't refer to it because he can't. He has to keep you focused on the very few statistics that make him look good, and it depends on programs like Economic Update and stations like BAI to make the other perspective even a part of the national conversation. And that, in my view, is the single most important reason why we at WBAI, need your help. We need you to call in. We need you to become WBAI buddies, which is a way of providing sustained support, which is the best kind for an ongoing operation like this.
And I know, this is Linda Perry, I know, Professor Wolf, our listeners so appreciate you. And I so appreciate that you are here in our new studio to talk to our listeners here on Atlantic Avenue. live in our studio. And we will be taking some of your phone calls at 212-209-2877. We are asking you to pledge your support to WBAI and become a buddy to Economic Update. I know it's one of your favorite programs. His analysis is so right on, so spot on. 516-620-3602 is the number to call to become a WBAI buddy. You go to the website, givetowbai.org, click on the upper left-hand corner, and click on a buddy, and then go down to your favorite show, Economic Update, and become a sustaining member of WBAI. We are offering a special incentive. Two books. You can get one of these two books by Professor Rick Wolf. One, Understanding Socialism, and are we going to offer Understanding Marxism as well?
Yes, I think if people are interested in one or the other, or maybe hopefully both, absolutely.
You know, I wanted to ask you, so Donald Trump, speaking to his base, is constantly smashing and denigrating socialism. We have a clip here from when he was speaking about, he was touting what his Trumpacare would be doing to improve the lives of Americans. He was saying that he would keep certain benefits that are in place now, previous conditions. It was shown that him and his administration have done so many things to go against this type of talk. And he kept talking about socialism. So let's just go to that clip, if we could, Reggie. And here's Donald Trump from his State of the Union address about health care last night.
As we work to improve Americans' health care, there are those who want to take away your health care, take away your doctor, and abolish private insurance entirely. 132 lawmakers in this room have endorsed legislation to impose a socialist takeover of our health care system, wiping out the private health insurance plans of 180 million very happy Americans. To those watching at home tonight, I want you to know we will never let socialism destroy American health care.
I would only respond to this comment, and nothing could be further from the truth once again. I mean, the man has no limits on what he says. His administration has blocked coverage for people with prior medical conditions 10 different ways over the last 3 years, in the courts, in legislative battles. To take credit now for him improving the healthcare system that the Republican Party and he as leader have blocked is an attempt to really enter the world what we used to call 1984 before that year hit. It's making up a reality on television and in the public eye, opposite to what you're doing, in the hopes that you can get away with that flim-flam kind of approach. But let me turn my attention briefly to his repeated effort to say, we will never go to socialism. Here's a little historical reminder. The leader of every country that ever went socialist, the last leader before he did it, promised it would never happen. Mr. Trump's promise is worth exactly what the promise of all those others were. And the only reason he's talking like that, well, there's two reasons. Number one, more young Americans, the future of this country, are favorable towards socialism than has been the case in half a century in the United States. Every poll shows it. And it's been true for years now. That scares people like him and the people he's appealing to. We've had half a century of anti-socialism and anti-communism as literally the air we breathe in this country. And so it is not surprising that there are some people who are frightened of whatever they think socialism is. But the young people, particularly those that are politically interested and aware, They're not fooled anymore. That's what's changed, and that's what's frightening these people. Just as the fact that finally there are politicians winning elections who call themselves socialists. So it isn't anymore what it once was, a kind of political impossibility to show you're interested. Understand Mr. Trump's trumpeting for what it is. He's scared. He's worried. The wind isn't going the way he wants. And he imagines by saying the opposite, somehow, magically, that's what's going to happen. By the way, this is not the first time. Last year, he also said the United States will never go socialist. And by every measure I know, there's more socialism active in the United States today than there was a year ago. Be worried, Mr. Trump. Be worried.
And the other thing that he did, speaking about putting down socialism, is he's been very instrumental in continuing the blockade of Cuba, and he brought Juan Guaido into the discussion last night, and we have a clip of that. Reggie, can you roll that?
We are supporting the hopes of Cubans, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans to restore democracy. The United States is leading a 59-nation diplomatic coalition against the socialist dictator of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. Maduro is an illegitimate ruler, a tyrant who brutalizes his people, but Maduro's grip on tyranny will be smashed and broken. Here this evening is a very brave man who carries with him the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of all Venezuelans. Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President, please take this message back to your family. Thank you, Mr. President. Great honor. Thank you very much.
So there he is. That's Donald Trump last night at State of the Union, calling Juan Guaido Mr. President, totally ignoring the fact that Nicolas Maduro is the elected president of Venezuela. And all of these people are applauding. They're so happy. You know, the Republicans and the Democrats are all there standing up. And this is just another way of Donald Trump playing to his base and really taking a shot at socialism and at the dignified ability for a president to be president in his own country.
Yes, if he had got the support of every person in Venezuela, the way the president said, he wouldn't have to be sitting in Washington. He'd be sitting in Venezuela.
And meeting with him
Guaido
today.
Mr. Guaido hasn't got the support of anything remotely like the majority of the Venezuelan people, nor would there be any way to ascertain that without the kinds of elections which we've had there, complex as they are, which all elections are. But those elections produce somebody else, not Mr. Guaido. So it's a remarkable effort, again, to rewrite what is going on because the reality is too complicated and too different and too mixed and doesn't work for the reelection campaign. But I would like to pick up on one point you made. There were a lot of Democrats who applauded, too. Like there are a lot of Democrats who support the trade wars and so forth against China, bashing China like bashing a selected leader abroad. Let's remember, Mr. Trump is the bosom buddy of the fellow who hacked the body of that reporter in Turkey, if you remember a while ago. No sanctions there, no problem, no difficulty. No, we have really good friends, but we call other people dictators. It's extraordinary when you think about the double standard and the fakery that's wrapped up in all of this. But the point here is, the Democrats so often applaud, too. One of the reasons Mr. Trump goes ahead and does the kinds of theatrics around Venezuela and around China is because he knows the Democrats have no way to be critical there, because they're caught up in the same ideological one-sidedness that America suffers from for the last half century. So he doesn't risk being criticized. It's as if bashing China is just open season, like bashing Mr. Maduro is open season. And when the Democrats fail to criticize the hypocrisy of all of this, the fakery of all of this, that we're all supposed to forget that the predecessor of Mr. Maduro was forced out of office for several nights by the United States military and CIA. I mean, it's well known that half of Latin America has gone through that experience in Guatemala, in Cuba, the efforts made. It's a long history. No other country has done those things in Latin America, just the United States, which is one of the reasons the support for Cuba and for Maduro is as strong as it is, thwarting the effort of the United States government now for many years to get rid of these people. But they can't because of the support those folks have out there. But the Democrats don't criticize. And in that way, they help defeat themselves at the polls.
Right.
They are the support. Just like the parroting of the argument that we're in a great economy means they've lost the chance to point out that the economy is far from great. And to drive home the irony, let me remind you, if you've forgotten, when Mr. Trump ran back in 2016, he had years behind him of regularly mocking Obama by saying, Obama says the economy is making these and these and these progress steps, but it isn't really true. The economy is a disaster. Now that he's in the White House, he completely flips around. Now the economy is great, and nobody should say it's a disaster. He made fun of the unemployment numbers that the Obama administration put forward. By the way, to Obama's credit, he never went crazy with the abuse of the statistics the way Mr. Trump did. But Trump attacked the unemployment numbers as not giving a genuine picture of suffering. That's exactly what Trump has done when he's in office. He's a flim-flam artist. That's what he was. That's what real estate often involves. And that's who he is. And the only question is whether he can continue to play in our society.
And this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Professor Rick Wolf is here with us live. We are taking some phone calls, your phone calls. I know you must have a lot of questions for Professor Wolf. I certainly do, but let's hear from you. 212-209-2877. That's our call-in number here at WBAI. 212-209-2877, and we'll see if do we have any calls yet?
No.
Not yet. Well, there's something else I'd like to talk to you about, and that is when Donald Trump slams socialism,
okay.
Is it also is he also trying to denigrate Bernie Sanders?
No, I think he's trying to play to the base. Well, his base are folks that have been told over and over again and have accepted in many cases the notion that socialism is some unmitigated evil and that Mr. Trump is going to block it, thwart it, prevent it. You know, it's the same. He's going to block the Chinese. He's going to block this. He's going to block that. So he's playing to them.
He's painting it as an evil.
Yes, in the tradition of Reagan, the evil empire, all of that. He's, in fact, afraid of Bernie Sanders. And the reason he's afraid of Bernie Sanders is not complicated. Think about American politics as having been governed for the last 50 years by Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Slightly to the left, that's the Democratic Party. Slightly to the right, the Republican Party. It's epitomized by Bushes and Clintons and all of that. And then comes a crisis, the crash of 2008, the second worst crash in the history of capitalism, second only to the Great Depression of the 30s. It shakes the country up. The leadership keeps saying, oh, no, we're all fine. We're going to get ready. The country's shaken up, and the people who live in this country, left and right, white and black, they all know it. They're living it. You know, this is the first generation of young people who can't get a college education without loading up with tens of thousands of dollars. They can't in a million years pay back. This is a great economy, not for them. We have more homelessness on the streets of New York City than I have seen in my lifetime. What's going on here? The collapse, the gap in wealth between white and black has gotten worse in recent years than it was before, and it wasn't good before. So the reality shook the American people, and they wanted from their political leaders some recognition of this and the kinds of dramatic something has to change is the feeling of the American people, left wing, right wing, conservative, liberal. So what have we had? Well, we got a little bit of change, the daring amount of change the political system could, by for the first time doing something remarkable, putting a black man in the White House, an amazing thing for this country to finally have done. And I think he was blown into that job, not to take away from his skills, but because the crash happened and the election happened and people understood we need something different. And the very fact that a black person could be in that position was different. But he was more of a regular politician than he was a different one. And so we got the next version of I'm different, Donald Trump. He's different in an ugly way, in a crude way, all the rest of it. You all know that. You don't need me for that. But he's very different. And he captured at least the right wing of American politics because he really was different. He didn't talk like the other people. He didn't look like it. He was a person with no polish, no Ivy League veneer, none of it. And people said, okay, at least let's see the regular ones, the Clintons, the Bushes. I mean, look what happened. He blew Bush out in the primary, and he basically defeated her in the general election. But it wasn't a victory for him. It was something different. Now the point. On the left in the United States politics, in the Democratic Party, there's one big different person, maybe one and a half. I don't want to take away. Elizabeth Warren has done a lot of courageous things, and I don't want to take away from that. But the one who went that last step, who said, socialism, yeah, I'm one of them. And now listen to me. This is what it means. Don't be scared by stories in the night. Here I am, an older, white-haired Vermonter, telling you this is what I believe in. And I'm showing you a person, which he does, who's been this way all his life. But I knew him a little bit years ago. So he's the same guy with the same attitude, only now it's sexy and attractive. I think Mr.
Is
Trump,
it sexy and attractive?
Yes. I'm a professor. I'm surrounded all the time with young people in the ages, undergraduates from 18 to graduate students up into the 20s, early 30s. There's no contest there. Mr. Trump came anywhere near American universities. In most cases, not all, but in most cases, he'd lose. They are not interested in that. And it's interesting because they're the young people, but they're interested in Mr. Sanders, who's one of the oldest candidates. That issue doesn't seem to matter much. No, I think Mr. Sanders has something like Mr. Obama. Mr. Obama's difference was visible in his skin color in a country that has a hard trouble with that. Mr. Sanders is almost, because he wears a little sign saying, hey, I'm the socialist running. And that sure makes him different because
people
Americans
believe in him.
Know that
yeah.
That's something that's been a pariah. And I think he is the most dangerous competitor Mr. Trump could have. So he's very careful if you listen to him. He could have 100 times come down on Mr. He's afraid. Those are his voters that will see a better shot with Sanders than they've gotten from him, because when the bluster passes from Mr. Trump, the reality is the situation in the economy for most people has gotten worse.
This is WBAI in New York, Professor Rick Wolf, and we're taking your calls at 212-209-2877. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Good evening. Thanks for the show. It's great to hear. I'm a supporter of BAI and a member. I had a little bit of a question or a comment on the State of the Union, since you were talking about it. There was an interesting sort of passage layered in that the president talked about. When he's talking about investment in neighborhoods, he sort of painted this picture, with his words about how, these poor neighborhoods would be invested in by these rich outsiders. You know, these rich outsiders would pour money in to these poor inner city neighborhoods to lift them up and help them. And I thought it was just a creepy picture. But it was an eyeball into, it seemed like, the picture that the president is painting, of a world. It's an untruth, but it's not a simple objective untruth which the president spoke. It's a little bit more of a kind of background untruth. But I was just wondering if that had caught your ear at all, and sort of what you thought about that, the kind of paradigm that it evidences.
Sure.
that the president is selling.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful example of how the same thing you look at can be understood radically different depending on who you are and where you're coming from. So let's first ask and answer the question, what truth, if any, is in this vignette that you reported on? And I agree with you, I found it interesting too. There is money by wealthy people flowing into poor neighborhoods. It has a name. It's called gentrification. It's when the richest people at the top want to live in certain places, New York, San Francisco. We all know where they are. But they've run out of a lot of the old space where rich people live. So where are those who are rich now and want to live in these sexy places? Where are they going to go? Well, they're going to go expand from the center city to the poorer neighborhoods, congratulating one another when they've picked up an old Victorian house in a poor neighborhood that they can get for relatively little, pour a lot of money in, and transform. And if you're a real estate hustler like Mr. Trump, this is your bread and butter. This is how you become rich. You hope to be the guy who facilitates, who brokers this arrangement. And at the end, a poor neighborhood can look very new and shiny with the multiple condo projects that are there. But what is never looked at in these wonderful fake stories is what happened to the millions of people pushed out of those neighborhoods.
And the small
They're
businesses.
Not there because they can't afford the rising price of land, the rising rents. That's why we have a homelessness problem fit to overflowing in this country, because this investment that he talked about is destroying the home possibility. Millions can't own a home anymore the way they had promised they would be able to. And the rents are simply too high, which is a movement across the United States. So what he's talking about gives you the facade, a poor neighborhood now with glitzy new buildings. But behind the facade, just like behind the little propped up veneer of a Hollywood set, the reality is that millions of people are hurt, so that a very small slice of the society can have a cheap opportunity to build a fancy neighborhood close to the cities they want to concentrate in. You're looking at the same phenomena, but you're seeing it in a completely different way. He needs to paint what he, as a real estate hustler, has been doing all his life, destroying the lives of millions of people pushed out of low-income and middle-income areas in order to make room for the glitzy apartments of a few. And that he calls an improvement in the society, because he chooses only to look at what's happening to those at the top and ignore everybody else.
And the small businesses.
Who are wiped out by that too.
WBAI, you're on the air. By the way, the call-in number, we're going to take a few more calls, is 212-209-2877. This is WBAI New York. You're speaking with Professor Rick Wolf. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, hello. Good evening, Professor Wolf and Ms. Perry.
Hi, and what's your name, and where are you calling from?
Carl from Bergen County.
Ah, nice. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Carl.
Hi. Professor Wolf, I have a modest proposal for you to solve some economic problems.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the Brown University's Costs of War project?
Right.
The price tag, according to that study, the price tag for our wars of choice post-9/11 is over $6.4 trillion. A few other numbers, 21 million, the number of war refugees and displaced persons. This is what our money is buying. Over 300,000 civilians killed as a result of the fighting. Over 800,000 people died due to direct war violence. This is a complete, and this is being put on a credit card, basically. And where I don't see the outrage. I mean, the money is there. It's just going to the wrong place.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And not seeing the outrage, first of all, let me congratulate you for bringing to everybody's attention. There is this well-known project at Brown University. It's not the only project like this, but it's one of those that tries to keep track of these things. Notice that the kind of numbers you just gave had no place in the State of the Union, even though the State of the Union is very much involved in the wars and the foreign military bases that this country maintains at the cost to the taxpayer. And at the budgets that Mr. Trump has given the military have gone dramatically up each of his years. In at least two of the 3 years, he's given the military more than the military requested in order to, I believe, buy their solidarity with his efforts. But in any case, you're absolutely right. That money did not have to be used to kill people, to send rockets into woods where the animals were disturbed, and all the other things that they do with it.
Or to the Ukraine.
Or to the Ukraine, or any in the endless interference in the countries around the world. The newest ventures are all over Africa, where there are troops and there are bases. This is a country that thinks of itself as the police of the world. It can't afford it anymore in the following sense. And if you don't mind, I'd take your question that way. Because that money is being used there, it isn't available here. That's the key issue. We can't relieve students of their debts with more. We have more than enough money to do that. We can't say to people who lost their homes in the crash of capitalism, we're going to make good your loss, although we have all the money to do it. We could take the steps needed to preserve our environment from the damage being done because we have the money to do it. But we're not doing that because we are thinking of ourselves as the policemen of the world, an endless war on whatever terror is supposed to mean, and endless provocations. Mr. Trump has succeeded in provoking the Chinese to rethink their strategies, the Russians to rethink theirs, and every little country in the world wondering whether it's going to be on Mr. Trump's list for who's a bad dictator tomorrow or next week or next Monday, and have their country threatened.
And last night he was so busy bashing immigrants and not even discussing one of the perils of our time, climate change. I didn't hear anything about that. No. This is WBAI in New York. If you'd like to talk to Professor Rick Wolf, 212-209-2877 is the number to call. I'm going to remind you, though, that this is WBAI's first week of our winter fun drive. And I'm so glad that you came in and you see our new studio here, Professor Wolf, which is really cool, isn't it?
Yeah. Let me add a word, just a personal endorsement. For those of you that like Economic Update, it really is important for me to get across to you that this program exists because the initiative taken by WBAI to create the space, to invite me and support me and work with me to produce this program over the years, to make it known so that other radio stations and so on picked it up. I mean, if you value what I do, and if you believe in the efforts we're making to literally become international, not just national, then BAI deserves your support, because BAI is the institution that did it for me. It's doing it for other people. It's going to be doing it for other people. This is an important institution to support, especially at a time like this in American history, when you have a government so determined to rewrite the historical reality and to distort what's happening. You need the counterforce of a station like BAI. So I urge you to join with me in being supportive, in your enthusiasm, in your listening, but also with whatever money you can help to support the station with.
And we need a strong WBAI. We really need to strengthen it, and we need your financial support to do that. 516-620-3602 is the number to call. Say that you want to become a buddy in the name of Economic Update, and can we give out a copy of your book, Understanding Socialism?
Absolutely. We just released it in November. It's an attempt right now in the middle of the United States election campaign, and with more people thinking about socialism than ever, here is a short, carefully written book to make it understandable what socialism has been and where it is going now. Because like every other living thing, it's changing all the time. The socialism that is caricatured by Mr. Trump is fading from the world. He just doesn't keep up and doesn't know it. But this book will explain that to you, and what the differences are between socialism and capitalism, or socialism and fascism. These issues are core in the book, and I tried as best I know how to write it in a way that any interested person can get something out of it.
Understanding Socialism. We're going to put that book into your buddy bag when you call 516-620-3602 and become a WBAI buddy in the name of Economic Update. 516-620-3602. Call the call center and say you want to become a subscriber to WBAI, a WBAI buddy in the name of Economic Update, and let us know if we can use your name, and I'll make sure, absolutely sure, that you get a copy of Understanding Socialism in this big, beautiful WBAI tote bag that you get, you know, by March 1st. There aren't going to be any more plastic bags. That's one good thing. And you'll have a tote bag, and in that tote bag, you'll have Professor Rick Wolf's book. So again, 516-620-3602. That's the number to call. I would like to see at least five new WBAI buddies for Professor Rick Wolf. I want to be able to contact him tomorrow, and I'll say, you know, this person, and I'll name the people and who is now a buddy to your show, Economic Update. I know there's so many people who look forward to your program. Again, 516-620-3602, or go to the website, give to WBAI.org, and click on that upper left-hand corner, buddy, and then scroll down and pick out Economic Update, and just give us a monthly contribution and become a sustaining member. You know, the BBC is going to be losing support because you've got this conservative guy now in charge over there. You know, people, this is happening all over the place, and we are non-corporate. We do not get any money from anyone but you. We need you. 516-620-3602, no commercials, nonprofit, non-corporate radio here in New York. So 516-620-3602, this first week of our fund drive. And we've done really well, so let's do a little better. And we did say we're going to take your calls, so I thank you for holding on. WBAI, you're on the air with Professor Rick Wolf. Hello.
Hello, good evening. I'm calling from Honolulu, Hawaii.
Ooh. Hi, what's your name?
Well, hello, my name is Kimu.
Hey, Kimu.
Yeah, I just want to, I've been listening to Richard Wolf, and I'm concerned also about the caravan virus.
Oh, coronavirus, yeah.
Coronavirus, yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh. I'm very concerned about that. And what's the that has on neoliberalism and global capitalism?
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing is that viruses can and have popped up all over the place. It has to do with, usually, with conditions of insufficient cleanliness, insufficient medical care. It usually happens in places where we could have taken the steps if the funds were made available to save people from that, from getting the virus in the first place. And at least, and the Chinese are good at this, responding in a massive, coordinated way. I don't know if you saw it, but the Chinese built an immense hospital in Wuhan, that part of China where the virus is centered.
In no time at all.
They did it in 10 days. Right. They built a major, that kind of coordinated, bringing the materials, bringing the workers, bringing all the technical skill, that also can contain a virus. It'll be interesting to see the media in the United States, the mainstream media, who were quick to condemn China the minute this happened, whether they'll give them the praise for having contained it in a way that is the envy of the rest of the world in terms of every other kind of virus. But I think you're going to see the effort of neoliberals, and by that we simply mean the people who think that the government should not intervene, that private capitalism, private enterprises and markets are some magical way for prosperity and growth forever, that kind of economic fundamentalism, which is really what it is, the parallel to religious fundamentalism. They're going to use anything that happens, a virus or no virus, to push their argument that somehow they're going to, I suppose, blame China's economic system for having a virus. That's a childish behavior, but it's what passes for politics. But I don't think it'll make much difference. I think it'll be like the SARS virus a few years ago. It flares up. It grabs everybody's attention. But my hope is, and my expectation, and I have some evidence from the medical field, that they'll figure out and isolate this virus, and they'll figure out how to. They've already done a good job of containing it. Then they'll have a vaccine to stop it.
And you've been listening to Economic Update here over WBAI in New York. Professor Wolf came in live. Will you do this again with us?
Absolutely.
Yay. All right. So glad to be able to see you and have you here live at WBAI. And again, 516-620-3602. Please do become a member of WBAI, $25 a year, or a buddy to Economic Update and Professor Rick Wolf, $10 or more a month. And we are going to give you Understanding Socialism, a new book by Professor Rick Wolf. Thank you again so much.
Thank you, Linda, and thank you, Reggie, and thank the whole family here at BAI. It's a pleasure to work with this station. It has been from the beginning, and it is that way now.
In restated Pacifica bylaws, amendments have been proposed and may now be found on the Foundation's website at www.pacifica.org for review, and have been voted on by the Pacifica National Board and are to be voted on by the station delegates, followed by a membership vote.
Pacifica Radio has been compelled under California court order to consider amendments to its bylaws. Now, these bylaws protect the democratic governance system, key to our mission of promoting peace and justice through our broadcasts. The court order was initiated by Pacifica National Board members Donald Goldmacher from KPFA, Mansour Sabag from KPFK, and Bill Crozier from KPFT. Crozier was one of the board members who came and closed down WBAI on October 7th. However, in the opinion of a large majority of the Pacifica National Board, the proposed bylaws amendments are destructive, a slap in the face at all the activists who struggled for years to create a democratic governance structure for Pacifica. It would do away with our local station boards and replace them with rubber stamp advisory boards that now dominate NPR stations. It would put Pacifica under the absolute control of six transitional directors appointed by those who filed the lawsuit. They would even have final say over all Pacifica broadcasts, including over WBAI. I'm Alex Steinberg, pro tem chair of the Pacifica National Board and member of WBAI's local station board. I urge all delegates and members to study these bylaws carefully and vote your conscience. This is WBAI, New York.